Welcome back to the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Happy NHL trade deadline. Let's bring in the guy that's going to tell us how chaotic today will be, or if we're in for a snooze fest, Frank Saravelli, NHL insider and president of hockey content at dailyfaceoff.com. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, Ailish. Welcome back.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it. What a day to come back. NHL trade deadline
day. No kidding. Your timing was impeccable.
Hey, I might have planned it. I was like, oh, I guess they need me. I'll come back. but let us know. Do you think we're in for a big blockbuster day, or has a lot of the dust already settled, at least in the Atlantic, we think?
Well, I actually think, you know, given all of the pieces that have moved off the board in the last 48, 72 hours, you know, I think a lot of people are heading into this deadline saying, man, this is going to be boring. Claude Giroux's gone, Hampus Lindholm, Ben Chiarot, Mark Giordano, All these big names that we've been talking about for months, they've all moved. But I think today has the chance to be really interesting in the sense that with rental prices being so high, I'm told that teams have engaged in talks over the last few days on some traditional or more traditional hockey trades. I hate the term hockey trade, but guys with term, guys that are going to be around for a while. And, you know, I think that the prices have made teams do a little bit of a double take for some of these rentals. And they're like, well, am I just better off spending some of these assets to go get someone I can have for a while? And so we enter the deadline and maybe none of these names will move, but I can give you a sampling of some of the names that have been talked about in the last 3 to 4 days. They include Travis Konecny from the Flyers. We all know about Jacob Chychrun. Tyler Bertuzzi's name has been out there for a week or so. Same with Brock Besser, much longer than that, Philip Zadina. But also some new names that I'm adding to my board this morning, including John Gibson from the Anaheim Ducks, as well as Jesper Bratt from the New Jersey Devils. So, you know, there's lots of really good players in play. A lot of these transactions, if they happen, may wait until the summer. But the fact that teams are engaging in those types of conversations today, just about anything could happen.
Well, that was one of my biggest questions heading into today, Frank, was how could you not look at a guy like Ben Chiarot getting traded for a first and a fourth and not go, oh my God, what if we dangled a defenseman with term? Okay, now I'm wondering, though, okay, if those names are out there, how many buyers are left for moves like that, though? Because my thinking would be that is there some fear now within some of those teams in the Atlantic Division that moved all in for some of those rental pieces that they're looking at this and going, what? Now the market is reshaping and we already sent out all our assets? Like, how big are we talking here in terms of what's left in terms of the buyers in this market?
Well, I know Toronto is the center of the hockey universe, or at least a self-proclaimed one, but take a step outside of the Atlantic Division for a second. Consider some of the other teams that haven't done much. The Colorado Avalanche, the New York Rangers, the St. Louis Blues, and then some other teams that have been building for a while, like the Carolina Hurricanes and Los Angeles Kings. The Edmonton Oilers have some work to do. The Washington Capitals, they believe, are still in their Stanley Cup window. And the Vegas Golden Knights have been awful quiet, and probably reasonably so, given all their injuries that have piled up and the fact that they're outside of a playoff position. But the Atlantic Division has become murderer's row. But in this case, moving forward today, there's so many teams that haven't done a lot that are exactly the types of teams, like, look at where the Rangers are at. They're like, if they're trading for someone, sure, they could have been in the rental market and they may still be at a lesser depth option. I've heard they've kicked tires on someone like Phil Kessel in Arizona. They need help on their right side. But these are mostly teams that are more interested in trading for term anyway. So the fact that it comes down to that today, it's all kind of lining up to at least be interesting. Again, not promising that anything happens. I don't want to be the hype man, but there's definitely talk.
Hey, listen, I think that's you're only doing your job here. You can only say what you're hearing, and a lot of what you just said, of course, makes sense. So the natural follow here is, of all those names, Have you heard of any of them being linked to the Toronto Maple Leafs? Because Kyle Dubas is someone that has said that he doesn't like the prospect of bringing in rentals. And when you mention guys, especially I think John Gibson's name, people's ears probably perked a lot in this market. The center of the universe correctly, by the way.
And rightfully so. Like, John Gibson's been one of the more consistent goalies in the league for a long time. I have not heard the Leafs connected to him or, frankly, any of the other names. I think there was maybe some initial early conversation about Jacob Chychrun and in terms of, hey, just checking in to see what the price is here. And I don't think the conversations really extended too much far beyond that. You know, Gibson and the Leafs goaltending, everyone's asked the question. I think Sunday was an indication with the signing of Harry Sateri, and in addition to waiving Peter Mrazek to gain some cap flexibility, an indication of sort of where the Leafs are heading on the goaltending front. Is it possible that they, you know, circle back and kick tires on maybe a bit of a bigger name this afternoon as a rental? I think it's possible. I think it's unlikely. I think they're kind of set moving forward on their goaltending. They've made their addition on the back end. I think they're going to continue to look around potentially at some forward options. But other than that, you know, they're hoping that when Jack Campbell gets healthy and comes back, he can at least provide them serviceable goaltending. And in the meantime, you know, maybe Eric Schallgren, this really interesting story, can just be a bridge over that gap.
So there was those rumors about maybe adding a Marc-Andre Fleury. That's out of the question now, it seems. But you mentioned a forward, and I think that's something that we discussed being a potential that the Leafs might actually to get onto today. If they were to add somebody, do you have any inclination of who that could be, or any, you know, thoughts of someone that might fit with their cap, might fit with their lineup right now, and somebody that might be a good fit for the Leafs?
Yeah, I don't think there's been a ton of talk about this one particular player, but I think just stylistically, you know, I'm thinking that someone like Tyler Mott could be a really good fit. Cap-wise, you know, acquisition cost is probably, you know, he's in the second round pick range. I think it's pretty clear what the Vancouver Canucks need to do after the way these last handful of games unfolded, as they were supposed to be in the playoff chase. You know, I think stylistically, he's sort of exactly what Toronto could use, someone that's versatile, someone that when he's playing in the bottom six can actually help drive a line. That's the type of fit that I think works. Whether they go out and make a trade for someone like him, who knows? I mean, there's still all that other talk, and really, it's not even talk. It's 30,000-foot view. Where do the Leafs stack up in the big picture? We've talked about this and talked about it last week. You know, you see the moves, Florida, Boston, I mean, Tampa Bay is, you know, maybe the biggest statement made in the last 3 to 4 days. That's heady company to be in. The Leafs are, they're opening any playoff series they start against any of those teams, maybe Boston notwithstanding, as the underdog. So how much more are you going to be adding in terms of trying to fit in a rental? You know, maybe it's time to consider an alternative, or maybe it's time to just say, hey, we've made our move with Mark Giordano and this is the team we're going with.
Well, that's my biggest fascination point with the Leafs this deadline, right, is someone that's looking at this from, I believe anyways, a logical standpoint. Unless you are making that John Gibson type of trade, it's hard to envision how you're getting like a certainty upgrade in net, right? Where, okay, we've talked about Fleury, we've talked about all these different names that have been out there for, what, a month now? And there's never been the one name that's just, oh, well, that undeniably makes you better. Blake even mentioned earlier in the show, like, Fleury's got an .895 save over the last 2 months. That's not a, wow, this guy's red hot right now, you want to bring him into the organization. So unless you're doing something foundational like that, it really feels difficult to understand how Toronto could push in more assets, knowing that they have such a huge question mark behind the team. But that brings you to, okay, well, what's the pressure on the front office, though? Because usually at deadlines, when you see teams get really aggressive, it's either they're trying to fit into a window where it's like Tampa, where it makes sense, and you go, well, of course they're trading first-round picks. They're going for three consecutive Stanley Cups. Or it's a Florida, where you're at the beginning of a competitive window and you have just still a pile of assets that you're working from. But for a team like Toronto that's been in this cycle for a bunch of years where the pressure is to win, the pressure is to get out of the first round, but also there are these things that are stacked up against you where you don't have the same prospects that you can give up. It's a tough rental market. Do you think that the calculus has changed in terms of what the future of Kyle Dubas looks like if this team doesn't get out of the first round, or what the future of this front office, just in general, Shanahan included, should these guys fail again?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's his job and it's Brendan Shanahan's job to park all that. I mean, it also comes down to seeing your team in the broader scheme and big picture and seeing the different holes that have popped up, and trying to plug all those holes at once can kind of be a fool's errand, let alone to try and do it in a year where all these other teams have loaded up and probably entered top to bottom better than you were to begin with. I think there's probably a pretty realistic approach. The fact that they weren't willing to trade a first round pick, the fact that they weren't willing to trade Matt Nyes, like, it gives you an indication of really what they're thinking, what their viewpoint is. And that's why I thought the Giordano trade was really reasonable. You know, they stuck to their guns. They felt like they added a defenseman that could make an impact and can settle down your pair, which could also in turn, or should theoretically, improve your goaltending if your defense is better. And then at the same time, in the same transaction, you're also able to add Colin Blackwell to really, you know, add some punch to your fourth line and put yourself in a spot where if you had question marks about Wayne Simmonds or Jason Spezza, that at least some of those can be answered. They kind of killed two birds with one stone there. So, you know, moving forward, and they did it without a super high acquisition cost, it's allowed them to give their team an opportunity with the assets that they wanted to spend and not really take away from the future in a big, big way.
So you came on here about a week ago and you talked about Giordano's interest in being in Toronto and that this could end up being a fit. And so I think after that hit, we really started to evaluate that differently. Is your sense, because of that, that Toronto moved for a player that's not only going to be here now, but is he's not a rental, that he'll end up becoming essentially, the way I discussed him earlier was blue line Spezza? Is that what we're looking at here with Giordano's future?
It's possible, but I think it also depends on his play. Like, I think everyone's curious to see what's it like for a number of different reasons. It's not just, you know, the being under the magnifying glass of being home. Not everyone reacts to that the same way. You know, I think there's some intrigue about that. You know, I think there is some intrigue about what he wants to be paid and also his play, and it's in and of itself. The knock on Mark Giordano has been just that he's lost a step. And I think the Leafs watched that really closely over the last few weeks. And I think their judgment was, this is someone that is really efficient. He may not be the fastest or quickest guy, but he's efficient and he thinks the game at a high level in the sense that, watch his play, there's no real unnecessary risk taken. If he's making a pinch at the blue line, he's getting the puck every single time. If not, he's retreating. He does fine in his own end. He's able to get the puck up and out. So they didn't see a lot of detriment in his game, and they felt like the cost was on par with what they'd be able to add, which not every team making a move, you know, this week and sizing up the market from afar was able to match and align all those things up at the same time. So half the battle is getting someone that wants to dive into the Maple Leafs and be part of what they're going for. Giordano, as I mentioned last week, signed up willingly, knowing, you know, what it's like here. And, you know, going forward, how he plays will determine whether or not he's back. I don't think they're in a spot where they're afraid. Let me say it this way. I don't think they're in a spot where they're afraid if, you know, there's a better deal elsewhere this summer, whatever happens, that he walks. They know, you know, going in full well that that's a real possibility.
Frank, I know today is Super Bowl Sunday for guys like you, and I hope that we end up with the type of day that you predicted potentially happening at the beginning of this rather than everything having been done. Because, yeah, it starts to get a little annoying for the content people as we get into hours later where only seven.
Yes, it's about us. Come on.
Yeah, it's about the content people today, not the fans. Frank Saravelli, thanks so much for making time this morning, man.
Thank you, guys. Enjoy the deadline.
Take care. That's NHL Insider and President of Hockey Content at DailyFaceoff.com, Frank Saravelli. Yeah, so that's really interesting what he said there about there still being a lot of buyers out there. And it also is kind of interesting for the Leafs because a lot of those buyers he referenced, like the Rangers and the Penguins, are also still in the Eastern Conference, right? It's okay. It's like still
can't the West
East.
Do something? God.
Yeah, West would be good. Wild, I'm waiting for you. Pittsburgh is still the most interesting team to me right now because the Rangers are still early in the developmental track where I go, yeah, what are you really going to do? They'd be one of those teams that trades for someone that has term, but Sidney Crosby is no spring chicken, and he's still playing amazing hockey. And they got bounced the last 2 years because of just tough stylistic matchups and bad goaltending. And so I'm kind of curious what the pressure is on their front office to see if they have to make a move. But, yeah, I hope we end up with an interesting trade deadline. So sounds like forward is a maybe. Feels like goaltender is done. Like, yeah, dreaming on a huge trade with Anaheim, that's the type of move where it's going really counter to what the Leafs are saying right now, which is they don't want to move their long-term pieces at this deadline under duress, right? That's the sense that you guys have been getting. Like, we'll talk to Friedman again. We have Elliot Friedman at 8 o'clock. We'll continue to ask the question of everyone with any insight to this organization. But my sense is they did Geo because it addressed two needs. And the prospect price was not too much. It wasn't a bite you in the ass trade. It was a couple second-round picks. Again, what I think is a steep price. I am a little annoyed that people are looking at two second-round picks as though it's nothing. It's like, no, we're just talking about Nyes and we're talking about Robertson and how valuable those guys are to the organization. Guess where they came from? Second-round picks. They were second-round picks.
Also, their currency. Like, you trade a second-round pick in this trade. You can't trade that second-round pick in another trade.
Exactly. But it was a calculated risk, and it was one that they felt comfortable taking. But yes, given the depth of field, given the lack of prospect depth, it seemed like that's the thing that they wanted to do. Ailish, you mentioned something earlier in the show I want to touch on, and I know, Blake, you're something to chew on is related to this player, so I'll have you set it up.
Yeah, it's time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
And Frank kind of tickled it there a little bit and said, hey, the asking price on a Mott might be a second-round pick. And I raised my eyebrows at that, and it's like, okay, for a bottom six guy when you just gave up 2 seconds and a third in another deal. So the something that you want here is whether Colin Blackwell has actually some potential to play in the top six for the Leafs. We obviously know there's a second line left wing spot that's been fairly fluid. Andrzej Kasha leaves a game in a bad way on Saturday. We don't have an update on that, but it certainly didn't look good. Blackwell's two most common line mates the last 2 years were Yanni Gord and Artemi Panarin. So he has played some second-line minutes. Now, the on-off stuff gets a little messy because we're chopping small samples even smaller. And yes, a 5'9" guy is generally not the type of line mate that Tavares thrives with. He needs a puck getter. But Blackwell plays a pretty physical game for 5'9". Some of the public defensive metrics speak pretty fondly of him. He had decent possession metrics in a bad situation in Seattle this year. So I guess, Ailish, something that I'm chewing on and I would like your take on as someone who's seen a lot of Blackwell up close is, do you see that second line upward mobility for him, or is he strictly a plug in the fourth line guy for you?
Yeah, so I mentioned that I had seen him play a lot. He was at Harvard at the same time I was at Dartmouth, so I was able to watch a lot of him.
You went to Dartmouth?
And then also at the World Championships this summer in Latvia. And I wouldn't be surprised for him to get a little bit of a look on the second line, even just for a test, because he has played, as you mentioned, with some talented players. I think the best thing about him is he is kind of that utility guy that can play all over. He can hold his own in with some of the best players like a Tavares, but he can also play at a bottom six role. And I think that it could be something to invigorate that Nylander situation. He plays extremely hard. Like I think Leafs fans will really like him because he's a workhorse. You know, I know the 5'9" thing was the first thing people were noticing, like, oh, he's so little, but he plays a lot bigger. Also, his cap hit is amazing. He's kind of like, I don't want to say a Bunting-esque thing, but I think he brings a lot of grit for his price. He can be used as a winger or a center. He does PK. I just think that underrated in terms of not getting a lot of attention and where he has played. He had a really good year with the Rangers. That was removed, like, played with Seattle. So, you know, not really the best opportunity for him there. But I think he's great insurance if Kasha is injured for a while. I'm excited to see what he does because he doesn't really have a lot of attention on him so far. I think Leafs fans will like him, as I said. He has played with Kerfoot before at Harvard, so I think there's a good connection there if he does get moved down a little bit. But I wouldn't be surprised to see him up and down from the second line, third line, fourth line to try to find a fit. That's why I just like the utility aspect of him and his work ethic. So excited to see what he brings. I have seen him a little bit, so I feel like I am also excited to see what Leafs fans think about him. But a lot of positives, I think, when people saw a little bit of a highlight reel from him being tossed around on Twitter last night, because he's a big guy in terms of his size, likes to hit, likes to get in the corners and be gritty. So, yeah, I'm a Colin Blackwell fan, I'll say.
They traded for this guy to play.
Mm-hmm.
This is not someone that came. I think that the way people looked at this originally was who? So it's a Giordano trade, but they add some forward depth, and it's a guy who could get in the lineup, but might not. No. He's getting in the lineup. He's drawing in. Mm-hmm. He's been sneaky productive now for a couple of years as a guy that has not been put in crazy advantageous positions, right? Like, half-point-a-game player is no joke on that Seattle team. Like, that's a nice feather in the cap. Ailish, you just mentioned that there's some bite to his game. He can do a bunch of different roles. They're going to find ways for him to play. So this is why I think you definitely give him a look if you think that there's any potential for it up the lineup, because what do you have to lose? You haven't figured that out. You just lost Kasha, and I hope Kasha's okay, but it's really tough to rely on him now coming back. And not only is it hard to rely on him coming back, you still want to be able to look at what your future could be, because, and this is something that Bourne has talked about, this is something that Kipper has talked about, this is basically anybody with a hockey background has discussed with Kasha. He needs to stop putting himself in vulnerable situations because he's going to keep getting hurt. And over, like, this is not a flukish thing. This guy is not the most unlucky human being on the planet. He is doing some of this to himself, and it's not just cheap shots and bad luck. So relying on Kasha at this point, I just don't think that you can do it. So having a look of this guy up the lineup, what are your other choices? What's the other option at this point, right? Like, you're going to go back to Kerfoot? Okay, maybe, fine. But that hasn't been very productive so far this season. Let's see if it gives them a jolt. And if it doesn't work out, then Ailish, I think you're right. Then I kind of want to see what a Kerfoot, maybe Nylander line looks like, and Tavares with some other pieces. It's not ideal that the Leafs are in this spot where they're still really searching to try to figure out two of their lines, because their top line is set and their third line is set. Those two things are obvious. They've got to figure out whether the second line is going to stay as is and just add another piece, as in Nylander and Tavares sticking together, or if they're going to move into a model where it's like there's more meritocracy or more balance between all four lines. That's what I actually find interesting about the blue line pairings right now, too. And we'll get into those later with Kevin Bieksa. But everyone keeps going, oh, the first pairing of Riley and Lyubushkin. And what are you talking about? The Leafs aren't really going to have a traditional first line pairing. They're going to try to move this as a strategy throughout the game. Defensive zone, you're probably going to try to have Brody and Geo on the ice. Offensive, you're going to probably try to have Riley, or maybe even, depending on what your third line or third pairing looks like, they're going to be on the ice in those sheltered minutes. I don't think that there's going to be the same traditional, well, this is your first and second and third, and I think maybe we're trending towards that a bit more with the forward lines too, where it's more based on situation than it is on just traditional role. And so, I think that this guy, this piece, he's going to just be a rover for the next couple of weeks here. He gets moved from line to line unless something sticks and obviously works, and then you just roll with it.
I'm with you on that. I think, like you said, the first and third line don't need to be touched. You can move to a situation where you're almost looking at it as a – you have your first line, obviously, and then you could – I mean, look, you'd never do this because of the salaries involved, but call the third line your second line or whatever you want to call it, and then it makes a lot more sense that the other two are juggling. This is playoff hockey, though, right? This is – every little advantage matters, so you're going to see some – not some. You're going to see a lot of matchup play, right? It's why home ice advantage matters in a hockey series, because you get that last change. You can play the matchups a little bit more. You can see who the other team's rolling out. So, yeah, I think it's good if we all get used to, hey, Tavares-Nylander line is the second line nominally, but they might get used a little bit like a sheltered line, or that third line might play second line minutes at 5-on-5 one day. That's just the nature of what a playoff series is going to look like. And JD, you're right. It's the same with the defensive pairings, where I don't even know how you'd rank the, you know, if Gio and Brody click, you're looking at a 1A, 1B, not a 1-2. And it's not, you know, it's not Housley. You don't just roll them out in order. You roll them out situationally. So good to get used to that ahead of the playoffs.
Well, also, what I would be saying to people right now is, what do you think the option is if you're not going to try Blackwell up the lineup? Do you really think, like, Nick, listen, I don't know who could have possibly watched Nick Robertson over these bunch of games and thought, this is a guy who looks like he's ready to play on a John Tavares' wing in a playoff series against the Tampa Bay Lightning. Like, I'm not writing him off as a prospect. I think that's insane, but the idea that he's ready for this role is a bit much to me. And I also don't know how you couldn't be looking at their depth at forward right now going, okay, Spezza has always stepped it up in the postseason, and Simmons has been better than I think a lot of people would have thought up until this point. But having those two guys on your playoff roster, there's less certainty with those two than I think there was even a couple of months ago.
I'd be surprised if Wayne Simmons is playing playoff games.
Yeah.
From what we've seen and given how their depth shakes up. And you know, you mentioned Robertson, we haven't seen it. And like, we can all be high on Matthew Knies, and you can wish cast on him joining the roster for a late boost after the college season.
I'm wish casting it.
You're not throwing him. I mean, maybe you throw him in the top six just to see, but you're not penciling that in, right? Like, we saw the Nick Robertson 2 years ahead of time playoff experience. You're just not doing that. So yeah, I think you try Blackwell there. You obviously hope that Kasha gets ready for the playoffs, but you're not banking on that at all at this stage, I don't think.
I think that Knies and Robertson and Sandin struggled from this a little bit too. Those guys suffer from the Andreas Janssen going from the Calder Cup run, or like his Calder year with the that's what the AHL trophy is called, right? I'm always confused because I'm like, yes, it's both also called the Calder in the AHL and the Rookie of the Year.
We couldn't have picked a different guy to name it after.
Yeah, exactly. Like, how many trophies does this guy need? Calder, all right? You get it. You're impressive. But yes, Janssen came to the Leafs with that series against the Bruins, and he was immediately ready. But it was, no, this guy's a different story. This is a different level of prospect than where these other guys seem to be at. He filled in, and then he was maybe the best player in the AHL at that time. So it's a different thing. Either way, I still kind of want to see at least, you know, just one or two regular season games with Matthew Knies. Give me a little taste. Give me a little sprinkle. Give me a moment. Let's take a break. Speaking of prospects, just eviscerating expectations and getting into just crazy talk stratospheres. The Rising Stars game has changed Precious Achiuwa and Scotty Barnes. It's just whatever those guys going to Rising Stars. I don't know. It was just maybe their love language is, what is it? Words of affirmation, because they got those words of affirmation and bang, both of them are truly Rising Stars. The Raptors, the Red Hot Raptors, they beat the Sixers. How is Precious Achiuwa doing this? How has he changed so much? We'll get Blake's thoughts on it next. And, of course, a monumental moment for Ferrari. The Scuderi are back. It's the Fan Warning Show. J.D. Bunkus, Ailish Forfar, Blake Murphy, Sportsnet 59, The Fan.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 59 of The Fan. JD Bunkus, Blake Murphy, and the return of Ailish Forfar. Simps rejoice. It is your day. Your
I did want to say that I got a lot of really nice messages, and I appreciate people reaching out, and I just wanted to say thank you. Whether you're simp or not, I really did appreciate the love and support.
So, how do you define the line?
I don't know.
Got to say, what a way for the city of Toronto to welcome you back, too. Like, we're on Zoom as we do this, working remotely, and your apartment is so bright, you're getting 7:30
a.m.
golden
hour. Morning. It's
beautiful. It looks beautiful in there.
Mm-hmm. It does look nice in there. Yeah, you got a lot of nice messages over the weekend. I did not. I was not. My inbox was not like, oh, you're so great. We love you. Talk about the Raptors. But that doesn't matter. I'm going to talk about the Raptors. Listen, I tried to trade them. I got no takers. I was told fan base too sensitive. So
yeah, JD was getting up. Like, you were getting some heat this weekend.
Yeah, it was.
You know what the worst part about this is? I know it's about JD, but it put me in a position to say nice things about JD and defend him.
Oh, that's
and I
tough.
Feel like that's really the – I'm the victim here. That JD's not even on the show on Friday, and I'm like, guys, JD's wonderful. He didn't – that it, you took it out of context. They cut off me calling him an idiot on the segment. So the real victim, yes, me having to pretend to have your back.
I'll be honest. I basically – those days like that, you're kind of like, oh, okay, well, whatever. And I've had a couple of them before where people take stuff. I think the more frightening thing is just how much people, and this has been a fear of social media forever, just love to incite hate, and that they will just take all forms of logic or reason or like anything and just go completely out the window and just say no. My favorite thing about it was I got actually a lot of messages from people where they were like, really obviously like threats and whatever and some name calling, some pretty
threats.
Like
threats.
Oh yeah.
Relax.
Oh yeah. Threats. Like probably I would say conservatively 10,000 accusations of racism, which was pretty interesting. I was like, okay, this is about as far of a stretch as it's going to get, but sure.
The defense of those people, you did say I would trade every Raptor except Svi Mihailuk.
Yeah, I did. Yes. Like I shouldn't have put that last part. But yeah, so I looked at some of these things and I went like, it's amazing that there are just these people that are feel like that's what like accountability is, or that's what they go, you can't joke or you can't make statements like that. But what you can do is incite hate and launch horrible accusations at people. Like just the leap in logic from some is just, it's a little frightening. I didn't, honestly though, I really don't care about when that stuff happens. It's more when you look at it en masse and you go, okay, well, the only one where it bothers you is you go, I know my mom is going to read these messages, you idiots. Like, I hate that. Like, that's the part where you're like, I don't want this in here. But the thing that I always take away from it, and you see this with Leaf fans too, with the Austin Matthews things, is I wonder what it is. I don't know if it's other cities, but I really do feel like there's a hypersensitivity to the Toronto online sports community that is a little bit different from other places, or whether it's the same. I haven't been able, because you hear this from North American reporters all the time where they come on and say like, hey, this Raptors fans just like nonstop give it to me, or Leaf fans, like, I don't know if you've seen the Spit and Chicklets guys recently, like their stances on Leaf stuff, or what just happened with our friend Mark Mathot when he said Matthews deserved to be suspended for cross-checking a human being in the face. It's pretty nuts. Just, I don't know. So the inciting hate stuff is weird to me over nothing, over sports, but yeah.
I think there are a couple things with it. One is, you know, I would have thought that winning a championship would have kind of helped with the inferiority complex of the Raptors that for a long time was fairly valid. And I don't think it did. And then the Leafs Leaf fans are just so sensitive at this point where it's like, we are allowed to make fun of us. You are not allowed to make fun of us. Blue Jays Twitter is the only good place to be right now.
I know.
Because every hour it's Twitter. Someone else hitting 108 mile an hour rope over the left field fence. Amazing.
No, and this maybe will bring us to F1 Twitter a little later too, is I love F1 Twitter because it's just everyone being excited about F1. They're like, carbon fast. Oh, this guy won. Oh. Yeah, everyone's excited for
all. Did he use the medium tires instead of the soft tires? Oh, my God.
Yeah, we love it so much. But, yeah, the other ones I think, you got to stay out of a little bit here. Also, yeah, I would just say that if you're getting your news from that particular place, boy, that's a tough look for you as an individual.
But here's a good pivot. So last night, the Raptors played 76ers. Those two teams have been in playoff battles before. They're in the same division. The 76ers have a lot of Toronto Maple Leafs fan base to them, where they've been good for so long and so much just keeps not working, and they trade core pieces and everything, that their fan base is particularly sensitive. So last night, me and a Sixers writer are like clearly joking back and forth on Twitter. Not like no one in their right mind would have taken it exactly. And then both fan bases are riled up at the tweets. And it's like, look, you know, Joel Embiid has tough games against the Raptors. Like, I'm sorry. There's nothing to get mad about here.
I watched the Raptors game despite obviously hating the team and trying to trade them out of the city. I could not have been more impressed with Precious Achiuwa last night. So it's like, you want to talk about Joel Embiid having tough games. It used to be attached to Marc Gasol, right? That's where the Embiid stuff really became a thing against the Raptors, because he stepped in and he changed that playoff series. And then he just changed the way that these two teams matched up with one another for 2 years. Precious Achiuwa, well, it was a two-part thing. One, I thought the Raptors' swarm defense on Embiid was incredible. Like, my God, I was joking about this with you guys before the show a little bit, and I know this is a little kind of, I'm trying to force this in, because I don't know what Raptors were actually like, you know, like the dinosaur. But there is a dinosaur feel to them where it's just like they attack in a pack and they just get on top of star players. And this has been their modus operandi for a while now of, hey, we're not going to let the star player beat us. We're going to go after, like, it's boxing one, right? But Joel Embiid is a physical force that you go, well, he's the number one thing that's going to hurt the Raptors, right? You get into a playoff series with a bunch of 6'9 guys against Joel Embiid, who stands out there in every game, even when he's out there with Jokic, right? It's just like, how big is Embiid? Is he bigger than Shaq? Is he 7'5"? Is he still growing? How tall is this man? How big is this man? And the Raptors find a way to just consistently get him. They are like a pack. They're at his heels. They're nipping at him. They're swiping at balls. They're forcing him into tougher positions. Like, the game ends because Joel Embiid has to go get the ball at the three-point line and take a horrible handoff. Like, the way they defended him and just the way that they're operating right now, and again, big credit to Precious Achiuwa, is just so confidence building in terms of what this team can be. And Blake, maybe this is how we get into Precious, but Precious Achiuwa is the guy right now who feels like he's sort of changing what they are with what he's able to do with on the defensive end and now with his shooting.
Last night's such a great example of the versatility that they saw in Precious Achiuwa and where he's coming along defensively, because he is a part of that gang mentality strategy in defending Joel Embiid, where, you know, it's not, that's not Precious Achiuwa guarding him one-on-one and Embiid shoots 6 of 20. And we're a couple months removed from Embiid having that the most casual 36-point game of all time when the Raptors were half their team was in COVID protocols. You need a mix of scheme and personnel. And yeah, you know, a couple shots to rim out or whatever. But they spend the whole game beating Joel Embiid up. They crash the offensive glass like crazy so that Embiid has to fight for every defensive rebound. They push him far, far out of the paint on the catch so that he has to put the ball on the floor and face up, or, you know, do the slow back down where you can send double teams at him. And Achiuwa was, you know, Achiuwa started alongside Khem Birch last night so that Khem Birch could take some of the physical assignment. They actually moved to Boucher and Birch for the second half. Achiuwa had a hand in the Embiid stuff. And then on the final possession of the game, they switch it up and he's guarding James Harden one-on-one.
Yep.
And we're a couple games removed from, hey, one possession game in the clutch. Precious Achiuwa is in full. Whoever gets the ball on the Clippers, that's who you're defending mode. It ended up being Marcus Morris, takes a bad shot. Really great defense from Achiuwa in that one. And, you know, James Harden is one of the most difficult players in the league to guard. We saw Scottie Barnes struggle with it last night where the, you know, by the end of the game, the scouting report of we want to drive him right. Barnes was so fatigued that not only did he miss two free throws, it's just like, it's kind of a pass. Like, even that play where Boucher takes the elbow to the face, that's a blow by on Barnes. Trying to shade Harden to the right. So Precious being able to do all that and spend one possession on Embiid and the next one on Harden, and, you know, two times in three games, it's a one possession game and he's guarding the ball handler. It's awesome. It speaks a ton to what they see out of him defensively, both in terms of quality and versatility. And then, yeah, he adds 21 and 9 as well, which quietly, he's had a very strong season, but that's only his third time having a 20-point game as a Raptor. He does it on 60% shooting. He's shooting 44% on threes since the All-Star break. He's really coming into his own here. And you know, I don't think we're talking, hey, the Raptors' ceiling is different or anything like that. But you're talking about a 22-year-old guy in his second NBA season, and you're certainly starting to see the returns of why the Raptors identified this guy as a potential core piece when they were looking at Lowry offers.
So I remember when they made the trade, and you and I talked about it, I believe, off-air, and we were discussing his ceiling. And I distinctively remember saying to me, the Raptors feel like this guy has a chance to be one of the best defensive players in the NBA.
Yeah, they think he could be an all-defense, if not a defensive player of the year, if he develops enough offensively to stay on the floor that much.
Right, and his versatility as a defender that you pointed out from last night is where I thought they expected him to get to. And it's not like he was a bad defensive player earlier in the season. He was already a good defensive player. But yeah, getting that type of a trust level, they obviously had not given him the keys to be that guy. That's usually the OG role where you go, okay, well, OG is going to be the guy that flexes between a big and a perimeter player in that way. But what do you make of his just offensive swing? Because I know I'm joking about the Rising Stars game and the positive words of affirmation actually changing his ceiling on the season. And it's strange. Like, Precious is playing so well, and he played so well last night, that he's not the lead story for us today over Scotty Barnes. Or, like, Scotty Barnes isn't the lead story for today, when he's probably, in my estimation, taken the Rookie of the Year slight lead. But, Blake, what are you seeing just offensively? Is this a confidence thing? Is this just like the opportunities he's getting? Because it's such a strong swing in terms of offensive impact that like a 21-point game where I'm saying, oh, Precious is open with his feet set, get him the ball, versus earlier in the season where it was, oh, Precious is at the rim on a roll, don't throw him the lob because he's going to miss it.
Well, there's a play in the second quarter that highlights it perfectly. And Siakam's coming down in transition, and Precious is the trailer on the left wing. And that is, go bring up a game where Fred VanVleet's healthy. That's where Siakam looks to get Fred VanVleet his shot in transition. And he finds Precious, and it's a smooth walk into it three. And yeah, he's probably not going to shoot 44% on threes forever, at least not the rest of this season. That's a still-in-development skill. But I think the confidence that provides is huge. He, you know, he's a guy who, let's be honest, 6'8", 6'9", young bigs, when you tell them, hey, you're allowed to handle the ball a little bit, you're allowed to shoot threes, that's fun. There's a fun element to what this guy and what the Raptors let guys work on offensively. And I think when that's clicking and the defense is clicking, other stuff comes together a little easier. And he's not doing it all with outside shooting or skill stuff. Like, he had 5 offensive rebounds last night. Like, well, he's going to have to get his garbage stuff and his transition stuff as well, because, you know, he's still not, you know, inside the arc, he's still not a great finisher. He's, you know, he's up to shooting 60% at the rim, which still isn't great for a fairly athletic center. He needs to improve in those areas. But I think the outside shot makes a lot of other stuff flow. And in terms of his fit with the other pieces in the core, it's a really important, like, it's super important that he eventually becomes a 35% three-point shooter above the break. Like, that's necessary for how the Raptors are building this roster out. But for now, yeah, the confidence seems through the roof. And, you know, the Raptors are the biggest believers in your defense leads to your offense. And that's why they're so turnover heavy and so transition heavy. And I think Precious is a pretty good example of how one feeds into the other.
Well, I just look at, too, is the rebounding, right? And this is just an every night thing, and it happened again yesterday. I don't remember
20 offensive rebounds.
Yeah. And well, what I kind of wanted to ask you is how they just are historically as an offensive rebounding team, because they're certainly the best. I don't even, if there's even a number that tells me that they're not in Raptors history, it's like, I don't care. They're the best offensive rebounding Raptors team I've ever seen. It's just, it's incredible. Like, you almost feel as though they're going to get multiple possessions every single time. Like, there's no... Okay, this is how I evaluate it now. Is, you know that I can be critical of Gary Trent's shot selection. Let's just say I am less critical of the shots he takes now, because I go, oh, someone's probably going to get that when he misses. And so I don't even care when Gary Trent takes the contested step back earlier in the shot clock, because I figure that Chris Boucher or Precious, someone's going to go, Scotty Barnes, someone's going to go out and get it. It's actually why, like, you know, we've had all these conversations about what the future looks like for Chris Boucher here. There was a lot of discussion around the deadline of, hey, if you're selling, is he the piece you sell? Now I'm kind of at the point where I go, what are they going to end up having to pay Boucher? Because he's a part of that special offensive rebounding unit that they can throw out there last night. Like, it's unbelievable. They just played a game against the Sixers where I don't want to say so far as they didn't miss OG and Fred, because obviously they missed those guys, but where it wasn't like, oh my God, we need one of those guys on the floor immediately, considering where the Raptors were at certain points of the season from a depth standpoint.
Yeah, so they're second in the league in offensive rebounding. Only the Grizzlies are higher, and that's basically just the Steven Adams factor.
No, but I also feel like, what is that based on in terms of, that's the entire season,
percentage,
right? Like,
yeah, okay, yeah, yeah, and it's percentage of how many of your misses you grab, and that's very Steven Adams heavy. He averages almost 5 a game on his own, which is wild. Like think about that. Precious's game last night where he gets 5 offensive rebounds and it feels like he gets every miss. That's an average Steven Adams game. Yeah. But yeah, pretty the Raptors are in pretty good shape. So it's you know, it's the 14th highest offensive rebounding rate in the league in the last decade. Offensive rebounding has pretty consistently trended downward throughout the recent history of the league. So this is a bit of the Raptors are doing something countercultural with their desire to crash the glass. And I think it makes a lot of sense. Like, you have a lot of size. You don't play a traditional center, no, but you're usually bigger than other teams at the 2, 3, and 4. And advantages. It's certainly not in advantage creation one-on-one. It's not in spacing. So what do? You run like crazy in transition and you extend possessions. And, you know, it's not surprising that every time the Raptors have one of these good performances where we're like, wow, they look so great. You look at the field goal attempts and they take 20 more shots than the 76ers last night. This is a game where the rules are you trade possessions back and forth. You should not be able to get 20 more shots than an opponent. And that's how the Raptors are thriving here. And that's how you get past. They shot 37% from the floor last night and beat the 76ers, one of the top teams in the Eastern Conference. So that's what a good Raptors game looks like, and a good win against a quality team. And that's without Fred VanVleet and OG Anunoby. Huge Raptors week ahead. They got the Bulls tonight. They got the Cavs on Thursday. They are a game back of the Cavs and a game and a half back of the Bulls in terms of getting out of the play-in. So we'll have a lot more Raptors talk throughout the week because, again, big week for seeding. Today, though, it's a big day for the NHL. It's the NHL trade deadline. And who better to talk to you about it than Elliot Friedman? That's next on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.